licked away at the wooden frames of the three boxcars until nothing remained but warped metal and twisted rails, scorched dirt and charred ties. No one talks about fire right to my face. They can't forget how fire changed my life. But I hear them talking anyway. April, 1935. The mail train. They promised through rain, heat, snow, and gloom, but they never said anything about dust. And so the mail got stuck, for hours, for days on the Santa Fe, because mountains of dust had blown over the tracks, because blizzards of dust blocked the way. And all that time, as the dust beat down on the cars, a letter was waiting inside a mailbag. A letter from Aunt Alice, my father's sister, written just to me, inviting me to live with her in Lubbock. I want to get out of here, but not to Aunt Alice and not to Lubbock, Texas. My father didn't say much when I asked what I should do. Let's wait and see, he said. What's that supposed to mean? April, 1935. Migrants. We'll be back when the rain comes, they say, pulling away with all they own, straining the springs of their motor cars. Don't forget us. And so they go, fleeing the blowing dust, fleeing the fields of brown-tipped wheat, barely ankle-high, and sparse as the hair on a dog's belly. We'll be back, they say, pulling away toward Texas, Arkansas, where they can rent a farm, pull in enough cash, maybe start again. We'll be back when it rains, they say, setting out with their bedsprings and mattresses, their cook stoves and dishes, their kitchen tables, and their milk goats, tied to their running boards in rickety cages, setting out for California, where even though they say they'll come back, they just might stay if what they hear about that place is true. Don't forget us, they say. But there are so many leaving. How can I remember them all? April, 1935. Blankets of Black. On the first clear day, we staggered out of our caves of dust into the sunlight, turning our faces to the big blue sky. On the second clear day, we believed the worst was over at last. We flocked outside, trading in town, going to stores and coming out, only to find the air still clear and gentle, grateful for each easy breath. On the third clear day, summer came in April, and the churches opened their arms to all comers, and all comers came. After church, folks headed for picnics, car trips. No one could stay inside. My father and I argued about the funeral of Grandma Lucas, who truly was no relation. But we ended up going anyway, driving down the road in a procession to Texoma. 6 miles out of town, the air turned cold. Birds beat their wings everywhere you looked, whole flocks dropping out of the sky, crowding on fence posts. I was sulking in the truck beside my father when heaven's shadow crept across the plains, a black cloud, big and silent as Montana, boiling on the horizon and barreling toward us. More birds tumbled from the sky, frantically keeping ahead of the dust. We watched as the storm swallowed the light. The sky turned from blue to black, night descended in an instant, and the dust was on us. The wind screamed. The blowing dirt ran so thick I couldn't see the brim of my hat as we plunged from the truck, fleeing. The dust swarmed like it had never swarmed before. My father groped for my hand, pulled me away from the truck. We ran, a blind pitching toward the shelter of a small house, almost invisible, our hands tight together, running toward the ghostly door, pounding on it with desperation. A woman opened her home to us, all of us. Not just me and my father, but the entire funeral procession, and one after another we tumbled inside, gasping, our lungs burning for want of air. All the lamps were lit against the dark. The house, dazed by dust, gazed weakly out. The walls shook in the howling wind. We helped tack up sheets on the windows and doors to keep the dust down. Cars and trucks, unable to go on, their ignition shorted out by the static electricity, opened up and let out more passengers who stumbled for shelter. One family came in clutched together, their paw divining the path with a long wooden rod. If it hadn't been for the company, this storm would have broken us completely. broken us more thoroughly than the plow had broken the Oklahoma sod, more thoroughly than my burns had broken the ease of my hands. But for the sake of the crowd and the hospitality of the home that sheltered us, we held on and waited, sitting or standing, breathing through wet cloths, as the fog of dust filled the room and settled slowly over us. When it let up a bit, some went on to bury Grandma Lucas, but my father and I, we cleaned the thick layer of grime off the truck, pulled out of the procession and headed on home, creeping slowly along the dust-mounded road. When we got back, we found the barn half covered in dunes. I couldn't tell which rise of dust was Ma and Franklin's grave. The front door hung open, blown in by the wind. Dust lay 2 feet deep in ripply waves across the parlor floor. Dust blanketed the cook stove, the ice box, the kitchen chairs, everything deep in dust. And the piano, buried in dust. While I started to shovel, my father went out to the barn. He came back, and when I asked, he said, the animals weren't good, and the tractor was dusted out, and I said, it's a wonder the truck got us home. I should have held my tongue. When he tried starting the truck again, it wouldn't turn over. April, 1935. The Visit. Mad Dog came by to see how we made out after the duster. He didn't come to court me. I didn't think he had. We visited more than an hour. The sky cleared enough to see Black Mesa. I showed him my father's pond. Mad Dog said he was going to Amarillo to sing on the radio, and if he sang good enough, they might give him a job there. You'd leave the farm? I asked. He nodded. You'd leave school? He shrugged. Mad Dog scooped a handful of dust like a boy in a sandpit. He said, I love this land, no matter what. I looked at his hands. They were scarless. Mad Dog stayed longer than he planned. He ran down the road back to his father's farm when he realized the time. Dust rose each place his foot fell, leaving a trace of him long after he had gone. April, 1935. Freak Show. The fellow from Canada, James Kingsbury, photographer for the Toronto Star way up there in Ontario, the man who took the first pictures of the Dion quintuplets, left his homeland and came to Joyce City, looking for some other piece of oddness, hoping to photograph the drought and the dust storms. And he did, with the help of Bill Rotterdaw and Handy Poole, who took him to the sandiest farms and showed off the boniest cattle in the county. Mr. Kingsbury's pictures of those Dion babies got them famous, but it also got them taken from their mother and father and put on display like a freak show, like a tent full of two-headed calves. Now I'm wondering what will happen to us after he finishes taking pictures of our dust. April, 1935. Help from Uncle Sam. The government is lending us money to keep the farm going, money to buy seed, feed loans for our cow, for our mule, for the chicken still alive, and the hog, as well as a little bit of feed for us. My father was worried about paying back because of what Ma had said, but Mrs. Love, the lady from Fira, assured him he didn't need to pay a single cent until the crops came in, and if the crops never came, then he wouldn't pay a thing. So my father said okay, anything to keep going. He put the paperwork on the shelf beside Ma's book of poetry and the invitation from Aunt Ellis. He just keeps that invitation from her, glowering down at me from the shelf above the piano. April, 1935. Let Down. I was invited to graduation to play the piano. I couldn't play. It had been too long. My hands wouldn't work. I just sat on the piano bench, staring down at the keys. Everyone waited. When the silence went on so long, folks started to whisper. Arlie Wonderdale lowered his head, and Miss Freeland started to cry. I don't know. I let them down. I didn't cry. Too stubborn. I got up and walked off the stage. I thought maybe if my father ever went to Doc Rice to do something about the spots on his skin, Doc could check my hands, too, tell me what to do about them. But my father isn't going to Doc Rice, and now I think we're both turning to dust. May 1935. Hope. It started out as snow. Oh, big flakes, floating softly, catching on my sweater, lacy on the edges of my sleeves. Snow covered the dust, softened the fences, soothed the parched lips of the land. And then it changed. Halfway between snow and rain, sleet, glazing the earth, until at last it slipped into rain, light as mist. It was the kindest kind of rain that fell, soft and then a little heavier, helping along what had already fallen into the hard pan earth, until it rained, steady as a good friend who walks beside you, not getting in your way, staying with you through a hard time. And because the rain came so patient and slow at first, and built up strength as the earth remembered how to yield, instead of washing off, the water slid in into the dying ground and softened its stubborn pride and eased it back toward life. And then, just when we thought it would end after three such gentle days, the rain came slamming down, tons of it soaking into the ready earth, to the primed and greedy earth and soaking deep. It kept coming, thunder booming, lightning kicking, dancing from the heavens down to the prairie, and my father dancing with it, dancing outside in the drenching night, with the gutters racing, with the earth puddled and pleased, with my father's near-finished pond filling. When the rain stopped, my father splashed out to the barn and spent 2 days and two nights cleaning dust out of his tractor until he got it running again. In the dark, headlights shining, he idled toward the freshened fields, certain the grass would grow again, certain the weeds would grow again, certain the wheat would grow again, too. May, 1935. The rain's gift. The rain has brought back some grass, and the ranchers have put away the feed cake and sent their cattle out to graze. Joe de la Flor is singing in his saddle again. May, 1935. Hope smothered. While I washed up dinner dishes in the pan, the wind came from the west, bringing dust. I just stripped all the gummed tape from the windows. Now I've got dust all over the clean dishes. I can hardly make myself get started cleaning again. Mrs. Love is taking applications for boys to do CCC work. Any boy between 18 and 28 can join. I'm too young and the wrong sex. But what I wouldn't give to be working for the CCC somewhere far from here, out of the dust. May, 1935. Sunday afternoon at the Amarillo Hotel. Everybody gathered at the Joyce City Hardware and Furniture Company on Sunday to hear Mad Dog Craddock sing on WDAG from the Amarillo Hotel. They hooked up speakers, and the sweet sound of Mad Dog's voice filled the creaky aisles. Arlie Wonderdale was in Amarillo with Mad Dog, singing and playing the piano, and the Black Mesa boys were there, too. I ached for not being there with them. But there was nothing more most folks in Joy City wanted to do than spend a half hour leaning on counters, sitting on stairs, resting in chairs, staring at the hardware and the tableware, listening to hometown boys making big-time music on the radio. They kept time in the aisles, hooting after each number, and when Mad Dog finished his last song, they sent the dust swirling, cheering and whooping, patting each other on the back as if they'd been featured on WDAG themselves. I tried cheering for Mad Dog with everyone else, but my throat felt like a trap had snapped down on it. That Mad Dog, he didn't have a thing to worry about. He sang good, all right. He'll go as far as he wants. May, 1935. Baby. Funny thing about babies. Ma died having one. The Lindbergh said goodnight to one and lost it. And somebody last Saturday decided to give one away. Reverend Bingham says that Harley Madden was sweeping the dust out of church, shining things up for Sunday service, when he swept himself up to a package on the north front steps. He knelt, studying the parcel, and called to Reverend Bingham, who came right by and opened the package up. It held a living baby. Reverend Bingham took it to Doc Rice. Doc checked it, said it was fine, only small, less than a 5-pound sack of sugar, and a little cold from spending time on the north front steps. But Mrs. Bingham and the Reverend warmed that baby with blankets and sugar water and tender talk, and the whole of Joy City came forward with gifts. I asked my father if we could adopt it, but he said we stood about as much chance of getting that baby as the wheat stood of growing, since we couldn't give the baby anything, not even a ma. Then he looked at me, sorry as dust. And to make up for it, he pulled out a box with the rest of the clothes Ma had made for our new baby, and told me to drop them by the church if I wanted. I found the dimes Ma'd been saving, my earnings from the piano, inside an envelope, in the box of baby Franklin's 90s. She had kept those dimes to send me to Panhandle A&M, to study music. No point now. I sat at her piano a long time after I got back from the church, imagining a song for my little brother, buried in Ma's arms on a knoll overlooking the banks of the Beaver, imagining a song for the Lindbergh baby stiff in the woods, imagining a song for this new baby, who would not be my father's son. May 1935. Old Bones. Once, dinosaurs roamed in Cimarron County, bones showing in the green shale, ribs the size of plow blades, hip bones like crank phones, and legs running like fence rails down to a giant foot. A chill shoots up my spine, imagining a dinosaur slogging out of an Oklahoma sea with turtles swimming around its legs. I can see it sunning itself on the swampy banks, beyond it a forest of ferns. It's almost easy to imagine, gazing out from our house at the dust-crushed fields, easy to imagine filling in all the emptiness with green. Easy to imagine such a beast brushing an itchy rump against our barn. But all that remains of it is bone, broken and turned to stone, trapped in the hillside, this once upon a time real live dinosaur who lived and fed and roamed like a ridiculous long-necked cow, and then fell down and died. I think for a moment of Joe de la Flore, herding brontosaurus instead of cattle, and I smile. I tell my father, let's go to the site and watch the men chip away with ice picks. Let's see how they plaster the bones. Please, before they ship the whole thing to Norman. I am thinking that a dinosaur is getting out of Joy City 100 million years too late to appreciate the trip, and that I ought to get out before my own bones turn to stone. But I keep my thoughts to myself. My father thinks a while, rubbing that spot on his neck. He looks out the window, out across the field, toward the knoll where Ma and the baby lie. It's best to let the dead rest, he says. And we stay home. June 1935. Summer 1935. The Dream. Piano. My silent mother, I can touch you. You are cool and smooth and willing to stay with me. Stay with me. Talk to me. Uncomplaining, you accept the cover to your keys. And still, you make room for all that I place there. We close our eyes, together, and together find that stillness like a pond, when the wind is quiet and the surface glazes, gazing unblinking at the blue sky. I play songs that have only the pattern of myself in them. And you hum along, supporting me. You are the companion to myself, the mirror with my mother's eyes. July 1935. Midnight Truth. I am so filled with bitterness, it comes from the dust. It comes from the silence of my father, It comes from the absence of Ma. I could have loved her better. She could have loved me, too. But she's rock and dust and wind now. She's carved stone. She's holding my stone brother. I have given my father so many chances to understand, to reach out, to love me. He once did. I remember his smile, his easy talk. Now there's nothing easy between us. Sometimes he takes notice of me, like coming after me in the dust. But mostly I'm invisible. Mostly I'm alone. My father's digging his own grave. He calls it a pond, but I know what he's up to. He is rotting away like his father, ready to leave me behind in the dust. Well, I'm leaving first. July, 1935. Out of the dust. This is not a dream. There's no comfort in dreams. I try to contain the ache as I leave my bed. I try to still my heart as I slip from my room with my kerchief of dimes. Moving slowly down the stairs, I cross through the kitchen, taking only some biscuits, and leave my father's house. It's the middle of the night, and I hear every sound inside me, outside me. I go, knowing that I'll die if I stay, that I'm slowly, surely smothering. I walk through the calm night, under the stars. I walk to where the train stops long enough for a long-legged girl to latch on, and as my heart races, I feel the earth tremble beneath me and then the sound of sharp knives, metal against metal, as the train pulls up to the station. Once I might have headed east to Mr. Roosevelt. Now I slip under cover of darkness inside a boxcar and let the train carry me west, out of the dust. August, 1935. Gone west. I am stiff and sore. In 2 endless days on this train, I have burned in the desert, shivered in the mountains. I have seen the camps of Dust Bowl migrants along the tracks. There was one girl. I saw her through the slat in the boxcar. She stared up at the passing train. She stood by the tracks watching, and I knew her. August, 1935. Something lost, something gained. He climbs into my car. He's dirty and he has a sour smell. His eyes are ringed by the soil that comes from riding trains. But there's a deeper shadow to those eyes. Like ashes. Like death. He needs a hair comb and a shave, and a mending needle applied to his pants. He speaks to me. "Where are you from, miss?" he wants to know. He shows me a picture of his family, a wife, 3 boys. The photograph is all he carries. That and the shredding, stinking clothes on his back. I feed him 2 of the stale biscuits I've been hoarding and save the rest. I'll be hungry tonight, what with giving my day's biscuits away. But I can see the gaunt of hunger in his cheeks. He asks if I have water, and I shake my head, my tongue thick with thirst. He eats the biscuits. He doesn't care they're caked with dust. He finishes eating, and crumbs stick to his mustache. He's staring hard at me, and his eyes water. "I've done it again," he says. "Taken food from a child." I show him my cloth bag with more biscuits. "At home," he said, "I couldn't feed them. Couldn't stand the baby always crying. And my wife, always that dark look following me. Couldn't take no more. Lost our land. They tractored us out so's we had to leave. Rented a while. Then moved in with Lucille's kin. Couldn't make nothing grow." I nodded. "I know." We talked as the train rocked, as the cars creaked, as the miles showed nothing but empty space. We talked through the pink of the setting sun and into the dark. I told him about Ma dying. I told him about my father, and how the thing that scared us both the most was being left alone. And now I'd gone and left him. I told him about the piano and Arlie Wonderdale, and how I wasn't certain of the date, but I thought it might be my birthday. But he was sleeping by then, I think. He was like tumbleweed. Ma had been tumbleweed, too, holding on for as long as she could, then blowing away on the wind. My father was more like the sod, steady, silent and deep, holding on to life with reserves underneath to sustain him and me and anyone else who came near. My father stayed rooted, even with my tests and my temper, even with the double sorrow of his grief and my own. He had kept a home until I broke it. When I woke, the man was gone, and so were my biscuits. But under my hat, I found the photograph of his family, the wife and three boys. Maybe the photograph was left in trade for the biscuits. Maybe it was a birthday gift, the one thing he had left to give. The children in the picture were clean and serious, looking out with a certain longing. The baby had his eyes. On the back of the photograph in pencil was the address of his family in Moline, Kansas. First chance I'd send the picture back, let his wife know he was still alive. I got off the train in Flagstaff, Arizona. A lady from a government agency saw me. She gave me water and food. I called Mr. Hardley from her office and asked him to let my father know I was coming home. August 1935. Homeward bound. Getting away, it wasn't any better. Just different. And lonely. Lonelier than the wind. Emptier than the sky. More silent than the dust, piled in drifts between me and my father. August 1935. Met. My father is waiting at the station, and I call him Daddy for the first time since Ma died. And we walk home, together, talking. I tell him about getting out of the dust and how I can't get out of something that's inside me. I tell him he is like the sod, and I am like the wheat, and I can't grow everywhere, but I can grow here. With a little rain, with a little care, with a little luck. And I tell him how scared I am about those spots on his skin, and I see he's scared, too. I can't be my own mother, I tell him. And I can't be my own father. And if you're both going to leave me, well, what am I supposed to do? And when I tell Daddy so, he promises to call Doc Rice. He says the pond is done. We can swim in it once it fills, and he'll stock it with fish, too. Catfish, that I can go out and catch of an evening and fry up. He says I can even plant flowers if I want. As we walk together side by side in the swell of dust, I am forgiving him step by step for the pail of kerosene. As we walk together side by side in the soul-deep dust, I am forgiving myself for all the rest. August, 1935. Autumn, 1935. Cut it deep. I went in with Daddy to see Doc Rice. Doc said, "Why'd you wait so long to show someone those spots, Baird?" I scowled at Daddy. He looked at the wall. I think he didn't care much if he had some cancer and took and died. Figured he'd see Ma then. He'd see my brother. It'd be out of his hands. He'd be out of the dust. Now he's going to wear bandages where Doc cut the cancer out the best he could. And we have to wait and hope Daddy didn't get help too late. I ask Doc about my hands. What, I say, can I do with them? Doc looks carefully at the mottled skin, the stretched and striped and crackled skin. "Quit picking at them," he says. "Rub some ointment in them before you go to bed," he says. "And use them, Billy Joe," he says. "They'll heal up fine if you just use them." Daddy sits on my bed, and I open the boxes. the two boxes that have been in my closet for years now. The dust is over everything, but I blow it off. And Daddy is so quiet when he sees some of the things that are still so strong of Ma. And we end up keeping everything but a palmful of broken doll dishes. I thought once to go through these boxes with Ma, but Daddy is sitting on the edge of my bed. My mouth feels cottony. I fix dinner and Daddy tells me about when he was a boy. He says, I wasn't always sure about the wheat, about the land, about life in the panhandle. I dreamed of running off too, though I never did. I didn't have half your sauce, Billy Joe, he says. And it's the first time I ever knew there was so much to the two of us. So much more than our red hair and our long legs, and the way we rub our eyes when we're tired. October, 1935. The other woman. Her name is Louise. She stayed by Daddy the days I was away. The first time I met her, she came to dinner bringing two baskets of food. She's a good cook without showing off. She has a way of making my father do things. When Louise came to dinner, Daddy got up and cleaned the kitchen when we were done eating. He tied an apron around his middle and he looked silly as a cow stuck in a hole. But Louise ignored that and I took a lesson from her. We walked around the farm even though she'd probably already seen it while I was gone. She didn't ask to be taken to my favorite places. The loft and the barn, the banks of the Beaver, the field where you can see Black Mesa on a clear day. She told me she knew Daddy and I had a history before her, and she wished she'd been there for the whole thing, but she wasn't, and there wasn't anything to do but get over it and get on. We both stared in wonder at the pond my Daddy made, and she said, a hole like that says a lot about a man. I didn't intend to, but I liked her, because she was so plain and so honest, and because she made Daddy laugh, and me too, just like that. And even though I didn't know if there was room for her in me, I could see there was room for her in Daddy. When I asked him if he wanted me to go off to Aunt Alice after all, Daddy said he had never wanted it. He said I was his own, and he didn't like to think about what Aunt Alice might do with me. And we laughed, picturing me and Aunt Alice together. And it wasn't a nice laugh, but it was Aunt Alice we were talking about after all. The thing about Louise, I'll just have to watch how things go and hope she doesn't crowd me out of Daddy's life. Not now, when I'm just finding my way back into it. October, 1935. Not everywhere. I walk with Daddy up the slope and look out over the Beaver River. Louise is back at the house. She wanted to come, but this is Ma's place. Ma's grave. Franklin's too, and Louise has no business here. She wants to come everywhere with us. Well, I won't let her. Not everywhere. Daddy says, she could have come. There's room enough for everyone, Billy Joe. But there's not. She can come into Ma's kitchen. She can hang around the barn. She can sit beside Daddy when he drives the truck. But Ma's bones are in this hill. Ma's and Franklin's. And their bones wouldn't like it if Louise came walking up here between us. October, 1935. My life, or what I told Louise after the 10th time she came to dinner. I may look like Daddy, but I have my mother's hands. Piano hands, Ma called them, sneaking a look at them any chance she got. A piano is a grand thing, I say, though ours is covered in dust now. Under the grime, it's dark brown, like my mother's eyes. I think about the piano and how above it hangs a mirror, and to either side of that mirror shelves where Ma and Daddy's wedding picture once stood, though Daddy has taken that down. Whenever she could, Ma filled a bowl with apples, I tell Louise. I'm crazy about apples. And she filled a jar with wildflowers when she found them, and put them on that shelf above the piano. On the other shelf, Ma's book of poetry remains, and the invitation from Aunt Ellis, or what's left of it. Daddy and I tore it into strips to mark the poems we thought Ma liked best. We weren't always happy, I tell Louise, but we were happy enough until the accident. When I rode the train west, I went looking for something, but I didn't see anything wonderful. I didn't see anything better than what I already had. Home. I look straight into Louise's face. Louise doesn't flinch. She looks straight back. I am the first one to back down. My hands don't look real pretty anymore. But they hardly hurt. They only ache a little sometimes. I could play right now, maybe, if I could get the dust out of the piano. If I wanted to get the dust out of the piano. But I don't. I'm not ready yet. And what I like best about her is Louise doesn't say what I should do. She just nods. And I know she's heard everything I said. And some things I didn't say, too. November, 1935. November dust. The weed is growing even though dust blows in sometimes. I walk with Daddy around the farm and see that the pond is holding its own. It will keep Ma's apple trees alive, nourish her garden, help the grass around it grow, enough to lie in and dream if I feel like it, and stand in, and wait for Mad Dog when he comes past once a week on his way from Amarillo, where he works for the radio. And as long as the dust doesn't crush the winter wheat, we'll have something to show in the spring for all Daddy's hard work. Not a lot, but more than last year. November, 1935. Thanksgiving list. Prairie birds, the whistle of gophers, the wind blowing, the smell of grass and spicy earth, friends like Mad Dog, the cattle down in the river, water washing over their hooves, the sky so big, so full of shifting clouds, the cloud shadows creeping over the fields, Daddy's smile, and his laugh and his songs. Louise. Food without dust. Daddy singing to Ma's piano, newly cleaned and tuned. The days when my hands don't hurt at all. The thank you note from Lucille in Moline, Kansas. The sound of rain. Daddy's hole staying full of water as the windmill turns. The smell of green, of damp earth, of hope returning to our farm. The poppies set to bloom on Ma and Franklin's grave. The morning with the whole day waiting. Full of promise. The night of quiet, of no expectations, of rest. And the certainty of home, the one I live in, and the one that lives in me. November, 1935. Music. I'm getting to know the music again, and it is getting to know me. We sniff each other's armpits, and inside each other's ears, and behind each other's necks. We are both confident and a little sassy. And I know now that all the time I was trying to get out of the dust, the fact is what I am because of the dust. And what I am is good enough, even for me. November, 1935. Teamwork. Louise and I take walks after dinner every time she comes. By the time we get back, the kitchen looks pretty good. Daddy only leaves a few things he doesn't understand, like big pans and wooden spoons and leftovers. And that makes me a little irritated, but mostly it makes me love him. And Louise, knowing exactly what's left to be done, helps me finish up. She was my father's teacher at the night school class. She never married. She went to college for 2 years and studied and worked, and didn't notice how lonely she was until she met Daddy and fell into the big hurt of his eyes. She knows how to keep a home. She knows how to cook. She knows how to make things last through winters and drought. She knows how to smooth things between two red-headed people. And she knows how to come into a home and not step on the toes of a ghost. I still feel grateful she didn't make cranberry sauce last month at the first Thanksgiving we spent together. Louise made sweet potatoes and green beans and turkey, and two pies, pumpkin and chocolate. I was so full my lids sighed shut, and Daddy walked with Louise instead of me out to Ma and Franklin's grave, where he let Ma know his intentions. And Ma's bones didn't object. Neither did mine. And when they came back to the house, Daddy still cleaned the kitchen. December, 1935. Finding a way. Daddy started talking about planting the rest of the acres in wheat, but then said, no, let's just go with what we've got right now. And I've been playing a half hour every day, making the skin stretch, making the scars stretch. The way I see it, hard times aren't only about money, or drought, or dust. Hard times are about losing spirit, and hope, and what happens when dreams dry up. The tractor's busted, we don't have the cash to fix it. But there's nothing saying Daddy can't do the work by hand. It can't be any harder than digging a hole 40 by 60 by 6 feet deep. Daddy bought a second mule with Louise's help, her betrothal gift to him. He walks behind the team, step by step, listing the fields to fight the wind. Maybe the tractor lifted him above the land. Maybe the fields didn't know him anymore, didn't remember the touch of his feet, or the stroke of his hand, or the bones of his knees. And why should wheat grow for a stranger? Daddy said he'd try some sorghum, maybe some cotton, admitting as how there might be something to this notion of diversification folks were talking about. And yes, he'd bring the grass back like Ma wanted, where he wasn't planting anything else. He'd make new sod. And I'm learning, watching Daddy, that you can stay in one place and still grow. I wipe dust out of the roasting pan. I wipe dust off Ma's dishes, and wait for Daddy to drive in with Louise, hoping she'll stay a little later, a little longer, waiting for the day when she stays for good. She wears a comical hat with flowers in December, and when she smiles, her face is full enough of springtime it makes her hat seem just right. She brings apples in a sack, perfect apples she arranges in a bowl on the shelf opposite the book of poetry. Sometimes, while I'm at the piano, I catch her reflection in the mirror, standing in the kitchen, soft-eyed, while Daddy finishes chores. And I stretch my fingers over the keys, and I play December 1935.
This concludes the reading of our story. Thank you for listening.
Hello, this is Jim Dale, narrator of the Harry Potter audiobook series. Listening to audiobooks isn't just great entertainment, it's also a great way for your family to experience and enjoy books together. Studies have shown that listening to stories read aloud helps children build vocabulary, improve their reading skills, and succeed more readily in school. It's an important step on the road to becoming a good reader, and one of the best ways to help ensure a lifelong love of literature for the children you care about. Thank you, and happy listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.